title was, is, well, there we go, At Home with Submission. And I was going to title it Submission in the Home. So we've been looking at submission for a few weeks now, and we had submission to authorities was the first one, and then last week was submission at work, and this week it's not submission in the home or submission at home, but it's at home with submission. And this image is an image that Emma sent to me to use for my keynote presentation. What do you think of it? What does it say, that image?
Yeah.
Train to fall over. What's it saying to you? Living on the edge. Does this look like a healthy way to have a house? You know. Right? Maybe bad contracting, but probably it's the home is in a precarious place these days. It's breaking down, and God has a plan for us to have a home where that's vibrant and healthy. And normally, the typical home is not that. And so we want to talk about what that means this morning. When I was in Bible college, Ruth and I got married in 1986, December of 1986. We went to Bible college, and we met at Bible college, and then we went to Winnipeg together to study at a different college. We got invited out to some people's place in first semester, a young couple, and they had a couple of little kids, and he was a very, very nice guy. She was a very nice woman, and then we got into their home, and it seemed like there was something different in the home than what they were presenting in the public face. And he was, they would both refer to their possessions as his possessions. So she would say, my husband is thinking about buying himself a new kitchen table, and it was always his possessions, his things, his kids, and they both talked like that, and she seemed to sort of cower when she was around him, and they justified all of this based on some biblical teaching of submission and headship. And Ruth and I left that home, and we felt sort of dirty inside. And we felt like there's something wrong. There's some teaching that has gone awry, that has damaged the home, and it wasn't good. A little while later, we were back in Calgary, and in March, I believe it was March of 1988, we call it the month of hell. Ruth was starting to learn to have an opinion. Oh, you're beautiful, thank you. Ruth was starting to learn to have an opinion, which I wasn't used to. We were both raised in very traditional, conservative Christian homes where we were taught that the man of the house is the man of the house, and he's the one with the opinion, he's the one that's right. But she was starting to learn to express her opinions, and I was uncomfortable with that, and she was uncomfortable with that, because the homes that we were raised in, that just didn't happen. Our mothers didn't do that, and so she would have an opinion, and it would be opposite to what I was thinking, and so we'd have this fight about it, and then we realize how stupid it was that we were fighting about this little thing, and then we laugh about it, and ha ha ha, and then a few minutes later we'd start to fight again. And so every day in March of 1988, we fought. And that's where we started to learn a little bit about the unhealthy teaching that has been taught in churches about what submission is and what headship is. And so I'm hoping we can clear some of that up this morning.
There's a few things that we need to make sure that we're aware of when we're reading the New Testament. Do not read the New Testament as if it's a second law. And we talked about this last week. The New Testament is not a second law. How much of the law did Jesus satisfy? All of it. 100% of the law. He satisfied 100% of the law. And what we tend to do as Christians is we say, yes, Jesus satisfied all the Old Testament. He satisfied the law, and then we read the New Testament as a second law, and we get bound up in law. Which is why Paul said in Galatians that we have been set free to be free. Now, that doesn't mean free to do whatever we want when it's going to damage our souls and damage the souls of others, but we do not obey or do the right thing because we know that God's going to be mad at us. Like he's this angry judge just waiting for us to mess up so that he can get at us. That's not the new covenant. So we have to make sure that we don't read the New Testament as a second law. Okay, go to the next slide. Religion says, I messed up, my dad's going to kill me. I saw somebody posted this on Facebook last week. Religion says, I messed up, my dad's going to kill me. That's reading the New Testament through the lens of the law. That's not what God's called us to. Next slide. It's fear-based. So that's fear-based. That is bad news. What does the word gospel mean? Good news. So the gospel is good news. Okay, Jesus set us free from sin, free from death, and free from bondage to the law as well. That's what Romans and Galatians are all about. The gospel of Jesus says, I messed up, I need to call my dad. It's about relationship. It's love-based, it's not fear-based. It's completely different. Jesus wants to do a work in our hearts. He wants to change our hearts so that we become like him, not based on fear, but based on love. That's reading the New Testament through the lens of grace. The gospel of Jesus says, I messed up, I need to call my dad. It's not fear. It's this healthy relationship with the God who created us, the God who loves us, the God who came to earth and died for us so that we could have life with him. The God who searched after us. That's what God's called us to. Another thing we need to keep in mind is be careful not to hear the passage today in a way that was never intended. You know, too often we've used this and other scriptures like it to subjugate women. How many of you have experienced that? Lots of us have. So we need to shift through 2,000 years of distance between us and that culture. We have to look at what was that culture like at that time, and we also have to look, of course, at the literary context, the biblical context. So Peter wrote to a particular group of people from a particular cultural context in a particular situation. He was writing about something. There was a problem that he was addressing. And our job as followers of Jesus is not to just read it without doing the hard work of finding out what was Peter trying to say to that group of people in that particular situation so that we can draw an application for ourselves today. We have a tendency of picking and choosing which things we say are cultural and which things are not. Many years ago, in a church, a lady came up to me. This is probably 15 years ago or so. A lady came up to me, and there was a new family that was visiting, and one of the young boys was wearing a baseball cap in church. And this lovely lady came up to me and said, "Go tell that boy to take his cap off." And I said, "Well, I'll tell him to take his cap off if next week you wear a bonnet and every week after you wear a bonnet or a head covering." And so she never went and asked him to take it off, and she was okay with that after that. She realized what she was saying. Now, did Jesus satisfy all the law or not? All the law. So when we read this, we have to make sure that we are not reading it as a second law. And here's some recurring themes that we see in Peter, we've seen so far. Number one, our behavior matters. We talked about that a couple weeks ago. Our behavior matters not because God is mad at us, not because it's the law, or not because it's our religion. When I was in high school, I heard this young Jewish man in class say that he wasn't going to do something that other people were doing because it was against his religion. And I thought, well, that's really good. I'm going to have to use that one. But that's not why we do certain things. That's not why we don't do certain other things. Our behavior matters for a reason. Number one, it reflects on Jesus. We are to be reflecting the character of Jesus. And so when others look at us, they should see Jesus. What does that mean? What are they going to see? Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Many times throughout 1 Peter, we see phrases like "for the sake of the gospel" or "for the Lord's sake, behave in this certain way." And so it's for the Lord's sake, it's for the sake of the gospel that we behave in certain ways. But it's also for the reason that God created us to live in healthy relationship. That is our identity. And when we live counter to the identity that God created us for, things don't go well. There's dissonance in relationships, and God has created us for relationship. Now remember the context of 1 Peter. They're living as foreigners. They're in a strange land. They're persecuted. Nero is the emperor at the time, 64 AD. He didn't like Christians all that much. As a matter of fact, he did things like impaling them on poles and lighting them on fire to be used as lanterns for their entertainment. He blamed the Christians for starting a fire in Rome, and that caused some widespread persecution. This is what we need to keep in mind when we're reading 1 Peter. So there is a reason that Peter is writing these things. He is saying to them, if you're going to live as followers of Jesus in your context, then this is what you need to make sure you do. And so for everything that we read in 1 Peter, that's what we have to read it through that lens. So we're going to read the entire passage right now. Okay, if you have your Bibles or a smart app, an app on your smartphones or something, you can open up to 1 Peter chapter 3 and starting in verse 1. In the same way, you wives must accept the authority of your husbands, Then even if some of you refuse to obey the good news, your godly lives will speak to them without any words. They'll be won over by observing your pure and reverent lives. Don't be concerned about outward beauty of fancy hairstyles, expensive jewelry, or beautiful clothes. You should clothe yourselves instead with the beauty that comes from within, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is so precious. This is how the holy women of old made themselves beautiful. They put their trust in God and accepted the authority of their husbands. For instance, Sarah obeyed her husband, Abraham, and called him her master. You are her daughters when you do what is right without fear of what your husbands might do. In the same way, you husbands must give honor to your wives. Treat your wife with understanding as you live together. She may be weaker than you are, but she is your equal partner in God's gift of new life. Treat her as you should, so your prayers will not be hindered. In the same way, he starts. So in the same way as what? So we've just looked in at chapter 2. Chapter 2, Peter says that we should all submit to governing authorities, right? And then he said, he's talking to slaves, and he said slaves should submit to their masters. And we interpret that here, since we don't have slavery, as employees should submit to their employers for the sake of the gospel, right? For the sake of the gospel, for the Lord's sake, submit. And it wasn't a good situation they were in. Right, slaves were being abused. Rome was a terrible governing body. There was persecution, and yet Peter was saying, submit to that authority. Why? For the Lord's sake, for the sake of the gospel of Jesus. So in the same way, and then he says, you wives must accept the authority of your husbands. Now, this is the NLT, the New Living Translation, that we're reading here, and it inserts a couple words that aren't in the original text, and it's must and authority. The original text simply says be subject to or submit to. Okay, now it's not wrong to put the word must and the word authority in there. That's not wrong, because that is the intent. It is an imperative. It's speaking an imperative. But the problem with using the word must there is that it sounds like law. Like you must do this or else. It sounds like a heavy hand. Now, Peter's audience was likely made up of mostly followers of Jesus, but perhaps the majority of them were women whose husbands had not yet started following Jesus. They were unbelievers. So the wives were either followers of Jesus who with Jewish backgrounds or with Greco-Roman backgrounds. Now, in Jewish circles, women were seen as the property of their husbands. So they had value maybe a little bit above their livestock. They were property. In Greco-Roman circles, they were a little bit better depending on where they were in the Roman Empire. In Athens, women could hold public office, they could have their own business and things like that. But a lot of the places, women were also seen as property in the Greco-Roman world as well. And they were certainly not seen of as equal to their husbands. And all over the world, even today, we see the same thing happening. It happens. Now, we need to keep this in mind when we're reading this, because this is the culture that Peter is writing into. So this is not Christian husbands making their wives submit. That's not what this is about. And if a husband feels the need to make his wife submit, then they've misunderstood the text. They've misunderstood God's call on them as a husband. We will never hear what Peter is saying to us in our world today until we confess the abuses of the past. In the church, the horrors I've seen in families based on wrong interpretation of Scripture it's mind-boggling. We need to confess the sins of the past. So, why were they to submit? He goes on to tell us here. It's going to become clear. Then even if some refuse to obey the good news, your godly lives will speak to them without any words. They will be won over by observing your pure and reverent lives. So Peter is speaking to Christian women, followers of Jesus, women whose husbands did not know Jesus yet. And so what's he saying? For the sake of the gospel of Jesus, for the sake of the mission of Jesus, in your situation, and by the way, there wouldn't have been any part of that world at that time, there was not equality between men and women. It would have been impossible to go and say, well, I'm going to get rid of this husband and go find another husband that's going to treat me as if I'm equal. It wouldn't happen. That was the culture. And so Peter is speaking into this kind of situation. If you are going to survive, if you are going to thrive, this is how you're going to have to live. This is how you're going to have to behave for the sake of the gospel of Jesus. He continues, verse 3, don't be concerned about the outward beauty of fancy hairstyles, expensive jewelry, or beautiful clothes. Now, if next week, if all you women come here without looking like you just got out of bed, I'm going to know I didn't do a very good job of explaining this. That's not what this is talking about. It's not saying it's wrong to wear makeup. It's not saying it's wrong to wear jewelry. It's not saying it's wrong to present yourself well and wear nice clothes. That's not what it's saying. Greco-Roman women were under tremendous pressure to look good. And in part, this was because the woman's appearance was thought to have a direct correlation on her husband. And so she was there as eye candy for him. That was where her value was. And unfortunately, we have done the same thing in our culture in the Western world. The value of a woman has been degraded to just how you look. And that's crept into the church too. So Peter is calling women to something higher than just being objects of desire. He's saying there's more to you than what you look like. You have more value than just what you can give to your husband. You have value, innate value in your own heart because you're created in the image of God. You have value. And appearance is secondary at best. That's what he's saying. He's not saying, come to church next week looking like you just got out of bed. Instead, so here's the real focus. You should clothe yourselves instead with the beauty that comes from within, the unfading beauty of a gentle, quiet spirit which is so precious to God. This is called discipleship. This is what we're all called to. Every single one of us is called to this, not just women. We are called to grow in the character of Christ. Love, joy, peace, patience. This is what we should focus on. Not outward experience, outward appearance, not building an empire for ourselves, not performance, but my heart. God wants my heart, all of it. What do I look like on the inside? When people look at me, when people experience me in relationship, what do they see? Do they see someone that looks like Jesus, or do they see someone, me, trying to be noticed? This is for all of us. And he says, this is precious to God. This is how the holy women of old made themselves beautiful. They put their trust in God and accepted the authority of their husbands. For instance, Sarah obeyed her husband Abraham and called him her master. You are her daughters when you do what is right without fear of what your husbands might do. What was the Jewish culture of Abraham and Sarah's time? It was very patriarchal, wasn't it? And in some cases, very misogynistic. Like the putting down of women. Their property of their husbands. So Peter wasn't saying that this was good. He's saying in that situation, in that culture, for the sake of the mission that God had for Abraham and Sarah, in that culture, this is how she was going to have to behave so that the mission could be accomplished. So we always have to say, what was the culture then? What's our culture now? What is God calling me to right now in our culture? For instance, when the world looks at us as followers of Jesus Christ, and they see us subjecting women, subjugating women, what are they going to think? Oh yeah, I want to be a part of that. I don't think so. God has called us to a mission. What's the mission? Leading people to become committed followers of Jesus Christ. That's what God has called us to. And so when we're living out in our community, when we're at work, when we invite a neighbor over for dinner, what do they see? Do they see love? Do they see joy? Do they see peace? Do they see patience? Do they see kindness? Do they see gentleness? Do they see self-control? It's all about the mission that God has called us to. You are daughters, her daughters, when you do what is right without the fear of what your husband might do. If there is fear in your home, there's something wrong. Fear is of Satan. We're going to take a look at that in a few minutes. For the sake of the gospel of Jesus, for the sake of the mission that God has called us to, what should our homes look like? What should the relationship between husband and wife look like? What should the relationship between parent and child look like? God's called us to something. And it's bigger than just our own situation right now. Now he goes, so he had this real long section on women. He's got this very short section on men, on husbands. Why do you think that is? Well, it's probably because most of his audience were women. In the same way, starts off the same way he started off with women. In the same way. In the same way as what? For the sake of the gospel of Jesus. In the same way. For the sake of the mission of Jesus, this is how you are to treat your wife. Husbands, give honor to your wives. Treat your wife with understanding as you live together. If your wife, husbands, listen, if your wife does not feel honored, then you're not doing your job as a husband. My number one job as a husband to Ruthie is to create a safe place where she can flourish, where she can become all that God has created her to be. And by the way, she's not here to hear this morning. She's in Alberta with her, visiting her mother. And I wanted to have her up here with me and do the sermon together, but she had this trip planned a long time ago. But my number one job is to create a safe place where Ruthie can become the best Ruthie that she can be. To create a place of safety where she can flourish. So, husbands, give honor to your wives. Treat her with understanding as you live together. If your relationship with your wife is dependent on her submitting to you, then you have the wrong idea of God's call on you as a husband. You got the wrong idea. And some of you husbands may need to ask forgiveness to your wives. I have to do that continually with Ruth. And Ruth and I will often ask each other, how can I be a better husband? I ask her, how can I be a better husband to you? And she asked me, how can I be a better wife? How can I love you better? Where am I falling short? And when I first started asking those questions, I didn't want to hear the answer. But then after a while, I realized for the sake of the mission of Jesus and for the sake of our relationship and for the sake of my own peace and well-being, I need to be able to hear those things. And so we ask this to each other often because we want to know how can we grow to love each other better. Because if I'm assuming that she's feeling safe and honored and loved, and I just continue going on as I was, I may be missing something. And so we ask the question. Really important. She may be weaker than you are. Now, I bet that I can beat most of you women in arm wrestle. There's probably a couple of you I can't, but... But men are typically physically stronger than women, right? Which is why we have different, you know, we have men's sports, we have women's sports. There's men and women don't normally compete together in the same sporting categories, because men are typically stronger than women. This is what Paul is talking about. He's not saying they're emotionally weaker. And as a matter of fact, women are emotionally stronger in some ways, because men have a hard time talking about their feelings. Any men find it easy to talk about your feelings? Some of you do. Most don't. And I still struggle with this. Ruthie asks me sometimes, she'll say, how are you feeling? And I'll say, oh, I'm feeling fine. And she says, that's the F word. I hate the F word. Well, so how are you feeling? Oh, I feel pretty good. And I have a hard time getting to the core of how I really feel. If I ask Ruth how she's feeling, 20 minutes later, she knows how to tell me how she's feeling. She is emotionally stronger than me in a lot of ways. She is also intellectually stronger than me in a lot of ways. She was the valedictorian. She wouldn't want me to tell you this, but she was the valedictorian in high school and in Bible college. And she knows her Bible better than me in a lot of ways. She has a better grasp on the languages than I do, which is why we go over my sermons all the time, to make sure that I'm hitting the mark. I go over everything with her. She is spiritually stronger than, spiritually more intuitive than I am. She is stronger in a lot of ways. So Paul is simply talking about the physicality of a woman. She is likely, not in all cases, but likely, she's weaker than you. Now, men have used this to their advantage over the years. It still happens. And there's abuse in the home because the husband is physically stronger. That should never happen. She is your equal partner in God's gift of new life. She's equal. It's not one up, one down. The husband isn't here and the wife right here. The husband doesn't call all the shots. And I read an excerpt from a book this morning, is quite old, on husband-wife relationships, couple relationships, and said that headship in the home basically means that the husband has the final say in all the decisions. And I just think, man, that is so wrong. The husband doesn't have the final say just because he's the husband. Ruth and I will never make a decision unless we have both come to an agreement. Otherwise, the decision stays, and we wait until we both agree on it. Because God has created us as one flesh. We're running out of time. I'm sorry. Can you hang on for a little bit? I've heard a lot of people say, especially women, who said that Paul, the Apostle Paul and Peter were male chauvinists. That's far from the truth. They actually raised the value of women in that culture, went far beyond what it was in that culture, far beyond. And so they were not chauvinistic, they were not misogynistic. They raised the rights of women. Treat her as you should so your prayers will not be hindered. This is how important it is how we treat our wives, how we treat women. We love them. We care for them. We treat them like they are number one. They are number one. They are the number one ministry God has given us. Number one. Not number two. Number one. And if your wife is feeling like she's playing second fiddle to your business, second fiddle to your ministry, second fiddle to somebody else, there is a problem and you need to ask forgiveness and make it right. She should always feel like she is number one in your life. And move on. Create a safe place. We've already talked about that. Husbands should seek to understand their wives. This takes a lifetime. I'm not kidding. It takes a lifetime. And vice versa. You know, for Ruth to really understand me, she's not quite there yet. And I'm not quite there in understanding her. There's so much to Ruthie that I'm just mining, just tapping the surface. There's so much to her. And so every time I learn a little bit more, I get filled with a little bit more joy. Like I'm seeing her, the real her. So seek to understand. Get to know her over time. Submission should never be emphasized by the husband. If you're feeling the need to make your wife submit, then you have totally missed the point of God's call for you as a husband. Totally missed it. The idea of submission has its root in the fall of humankind. Now, that may be kind of shocking to some of you. Genesis 3:16. God is speaking to whom here? Eve. After the fall, this is one of the curses. This is not God's original intent. He says, you will desire to control your husband. How many of you women desire to control your husbands? But he will rule over you. This is not God's original intent. What was God's original intent for marriage? One flesh. Equality. And by the way, when the Bible says that God will make a helpmeet for Adam, which was Eve, that word helpmeet is used in the Bible mostly of God. God is our helper. He's our deliverer. What we just read in 1 Peter was Peter wrote to a specific situation in a specific culture. And it's very important that we don't read it at a surface level and say, okay, no, I must make my wife submit. The gospel of Jesus, living for the sake of the gospel, is transcultural. That goes through every culture. It is why we exist. It's why God hasn't taken us to heaven yet, because he's got a job for us to do. That's transcultural. And so when we read anything in the New Testament, we need to put that lens on and read it through that lens. And the question is always, what does love look like in my situation? What does love look like in my situation? When somebody looks at me and how I treat my husband or how I treat my wife, what do they see? Do they see Jesus? Do they see a gentle spirit? Do they see love? Do they see joy? Do they see peace? Do they see kindness? What do they see? Are they attracted to Jesus because of how I relate in my family? No matter what your situation is, in your home, at work, in the school place, in your neighborhood, your job is to live so that others would see Jesus in you. Which means, it doesn't mean that if some of you are feeling guilt and shame right now because you've sort of got it wrong, it's okay. It just means the next year at this time, I should be more loving and joyful and kind and gentle than I am right now. And today, I should be more of all those things than I was last year. There should be movement towards being more like Jesus. We aren't going to get it bang right just like that. But he's chipping away at our rough characters so that we become like Jesus. So how are we in the year 2019 to live in our culture so that people will see Jesus in us? Did you know that I just looked up this morning. In 1918, women were given the right to vote in Canada. You know that? 1918. Not all women, though. If you were of color, you weren't given the right to vote until about 1960. And a lot of these things were justified biblically. And it's wrong. Now, I'm not a feminist like our prime minister, because I think feminism has gone way too far. But we need to do some serious work at raising up the value of women. And it's going to start in the home. How do I treat my wife? How do I treat my daughters, if you have daughters? How are you raising them? With value. The home should be the safest place that there is. And the church should be a part of that.